Thank you all for coming tonight. My name is Shira Weiss, and we are going to be discussing philosophical themes in Tanakh over the next 8 weeks. I'm obviously new to this technology. If you can't hear me, if you can't see me, or if you can't see the text on the right-hand side of your screen, just either, if you have a microphone, you can interject, or you can write in the chat box, and I'll try to adjust it as best as I can. Is everyone good? Okay. So we'll begin.
If you could talk a touch louder.
Maybe this will help as well. Okay. Feel free to interject whenever as this year progresses. All right. So as you know, the Torah deals with many philosophical concepts and teaches many philosophical lessons. And therefore, much of medieval and modern Jewish philosophy is devoted to interpreting these biblical texts. Over the course of the next 8 weeks, we're going to be looking at four specific philosophically challenging biblical narratives with the hopes of, through an analysis, arriving at a greater understanding on a literary level of the biblical text, as well as a more sophisticated understanding of the philosophical issues that are involved within them. Now, the four topics that we're going to be discussing, and we're going to probably spend two classes on each topic, we'll start with tonight the philosophical dilemma between personal autonomy on the one hand versus religious authority on the other. And we're going to be looking at that through the narrative of Gan Eden, the narrative of Adam's sin in Perek Gimel of Bereishit. After that, in the third and the fourth class, we're going to be dealing with the philosophical dilemma of divine command versus human morality. And we're going to be looking at that through the very challenging philosophical text of Akedat Yitzchak, the narrative in Vayera that we just read in the Parsha last week. The next two classes we're going to be spending on philosophical dilemma of determinism versus human free will. And we're going to be looking at that through the narrative in Shmos of the hardening of Paro's heart, where Hashem hardens Paro's heart. And then the last two classes we're going to be spending dealing with probably the most complex of these philosophical dilemmas, that of the problem of evil, or theodicy, tzadik v'ra'lo, why bad things happen to good people, versus divine omnibenevolence, God's goodness. And we're going to be looking at that through Sefer Iyyub, the book of Job. Now, if you have any questions on any philosophical terminology that I use, or Hebrew terms that you're not familiar with, or just questions, comments in general in the content, please feel free to interject, please feel free to write questions in the chat box, and I'll try to respond throughout this year. But I really like this to be interactive, so please don't hesitate. Okay, so the first dilemma, as I just mentioned, that we're going to be dealing with starting tonight is the philosophical conflict between personal autonomy on the one hand and religious authority on the other. And basically what I mean by this dilemma is this kind of conflict between acting autonomously based on our own conclusions that we arrive at through reason versus submitting to an overarching authoritative tradition. Now, this is not a new conflict. In fact, in medieval times, especially in the time of the Rambam, in the 12th century, when Aristotelian philosophy was extremely prevalent, was extremely influential, this issue created a tremendous controversy. And in essence, the Aristotelian philosophers viewed traditional authority as neglecting autonomous reasoning, and which they felt was man's supreme faculty, while the traditionalists viewed these Aristotelian philosophers as abandoning the objective spiritual framework that has been passed down to us through an unbroken chain of tradition since Har Sinai, since the revelation at Mount Sinai. This dilemma, however, was not resolved in medieval times, but it continues to persist, perhaps even more so, in our contemporary times, and we continue to struggle in this autonomous age in which we live. And to illustrate this emphasis on autonomy today, less than 2 years ago, a faculty committee in Harvard came out with conclusions on what they deemed to be the purpose of education. And I'm going to just put in the chat box here the quote that they came out with, if you can read it there, so you can read along with me. This faculty committee in Harvard University concluded that the purpose of education is, quote, to unsettle presumptions to defamiliarize the familiar, to reveal what is going on beneath and behind appearances, to disorient young people, and to help them to find ways to reorient themselves. So basically what these professors at Harvard were emphasizing is that there is no need for tradition. We should all arrive autonomously at our own conclusions. They were aiming at unsettling presumptions, defamiliarizing the familiar, and finding ways to autonomously reorient ourselves. So this seems to be quite in conflict with our submission to religious authority. So let's first deal with the biblical narrative in Parakimel of Rishi, and we'll see how philosophers interpret Adam Sin as dealing with this philosophical conflict between autonomy and authority. And then hopefully we'll be able to extract from it the larger philosophical lessons that we'll be able to internalize into our own modern lives. All right, so before we get into the philosophical or the biblical text, we first need a bit of background. So before we look at Adam Sin in Gan Eden, we have to start out with understanding the creation of man. And that'll help us better understand the actual sin. So if you look at the right-hand side, you'll see the sources. And source number one, in the very first pasuk that I quoted there, we see the creation of man. Is there an English translation? I'm going to be translating it for you. The philosophical sources are all in English. I'm going to be translating the Hebrew of the text for you. But I want you to see some of the words in the text. Okay? So if you look at Bereshit Perek Aleph, this is describing the sixth day of creation. Now in the first Perek, in the first chapter of Bereshit, we have the 6 days of creation, the subsequent phases of creation where all of the lower beings, all of the lower species were created. And at the culmination of this creative process, on the sixth day, God created man. And in Bereshit Perek Aleph Pasuk Kafzayin, which you see is the first pasuk quoted in source number one, we see how God creates man. And it says there, V'ivra Elohim et Adam b'tzalmo, b'tzelem Elohim bara oto, zachar nekeva bara otam. That God created man in his image, in the image of God created he him, male and female, he created them. So the first philosophical problem that philosophers deal with regard to this pasuk, is that what does it mean that God created man b'tzelem Elohim? The literal explanation of this text seems to imply that if we were created in God's image, and we know that we're physical, the literal explanation of the text seems to imply that that must mean God is physical as well. And this was a misconception that many readers of the Bible accepted from the literal text. Now, philosophers, especially there's plain philosophers that were very prevalent in medieval times, took great issue with that because they said since God is infinite, he cannot be corporeal, he cannot be physical, he cannot have a body because that would be limiting to God. And therefore, they found this text to be in complete conflict with philosophy. Now, Rambam, the most prominent of all the medieval philosophers, felt the need in his Moreh Nevuchim, the Guide of the Perplexed, to deal with these seeming conflicts between philosophy on the one hand and Torah, or tradition, or the literal explanation of the text on the other hand. And he wanted to show the people in his generations who were navol, who were perplexed, that they didn't need to either follow philosophy and abandon Judaism, or follow Judaism and thereby abandon philosophy, but he wanted to show them rather that the two could be synthesized, that you could accept them both, that you can reconcile them. And he devoted his entire Moreh Nevuchim, the Guide of the Perplexed, to deal with explaining what he says in his introduction, explaining obscure terms, and explaining obscure parables, okay? He wanted to explain the seeming conflicts between these obscure terms that seem to conflict with philosophy and obscure parables, which we're going to see in a minute. Okay, so if you just look back, actually scroll down a bit more, we'll see how he deals with this. Okay, so if you look at source number two, and we're going to come back to the rest of source number one. Whoops. Right. Let me get this back. Okay, if you look back at at source number two now. He deals with this issue of telemelikim. He tries to reconcile the seeming conflict between the text that seems to imply that God has a body versus the philosophy that we know that God is incorporeal. God does not have a body. God's not physical. So he starts out this chapter, and this is taken from the very first chapter of the very first book of The God of the Perplexed. He starts out by stating the misconception, or stating the philosophical problem. So look what he says there. Okay? He says here, people have thought that in the Hebrew language, tselem, image, denotes the shape and configuration of a thing. This supposition has led them to the pure doctrine of the corporeality of God on account of his saying, let us make man in our image. For they thought that God has a man's form, I mean his shape and configuration. The pure doctrine of corporeality of God was a necessary consequence to be accepted by them. They accordingly believed in it and deemed that if they abandoned their belief, they would give the lie to the biblical text, and they would even make the deity to be nothing at all unless they thought that God was a body provided with a face and a hand like them in shape and configuration. However, he is in the pure and more resplendent Suzanne. Is someone else controlling this? Because I'm not. Okay, there we go. However, okay, so that's the right thing. However, he is, in their view, bigger and more resplendent than they themselves, and the matter of which he is composed is not flesh and blood. So basically, in this first paragraph of the first chapter of Moreh Nebuchim, he's explaining the misconception. People felt that in order to really understand the Torah, they needed to take it literally, and therefore they felt that they needed to believe that God was corporeal, God had a body. And they just figured he was more resplendent, he was more grandiose, he was more magnificent than them, but he was a physical being, even if he wasn't necessarily made up of flesh and blood. So now Rambam is going to reconcile, he's going to resolve this misconception. And he says here in the second paragraph there, he says, now I say that in the Hebrew language, the proper term designating the form that is well known among the multitude, namely that form which is the shape and configuration of a thing, is toar. This term is never applied to the deity. The term tselem, image, on the other hand, is applied to the natural form, I mean to the notion in virtue of which a thing is constituted as a substance and becomes what it is. It is the true reality of the thing insofar as the latter is that particular being. In man, that notion is that from which human apprehension derives. It's on account of this intellectual apprehension that instead of man, in the image of God, created he him. Okay? So, he's explaining, he's resolving this misconception by saying that had the Torah wanted to describe God in physical terms, it would have used the word toar, right? The most familiar reference to the word toar is in the description of an Eisha Yichat toar. In the beginning of Parshat Kitetzeh, in Sefer Devarim, it talks about the situation of an Eisha Yichat toar. If a Jewish soldier who is part of a victorious army sees a captive woman on the non-Jewish side, and he desires her physically because she has an Eisha Yichat toar, she has a beautiful physical form, the Torah goes on to explain different measures that need to be taken in order to permit him to take her to be a wife. And it's clear in this reference that his initial attraction to her is purely physical. So there the word toar is appropriate because it's denoting a physical form. Any reference to the word toar, Rambam says, in the Torah always refers to physicality, to a physical form. And nowhere in the Torah does the word toar refer to Hashem. By contrast, the word tselem, Rambam says, I have a question, can you send me the source by email? I can send it to you after, I just can't do it right now, but I can send it to you after by email, the sources. But it's taken from Book 1, Chapter 1, in the Moreh Nebuchim. However, the word tselem is never, ever used to refer to a physical form. Rather, the word image connotes the essence of something, the distinguishing feature of something. Now, for humanity, the distinguishing feature, that which distinguishes us from all the lower forms of creation, is our intellect. And therefore, the word tselem here, when we were created, but tselem Elohim, Rambam uses, that means that we were created in God's intellectual image. That is what distinguishes us from all of the lower forms of creation. Okay. Understanding that, we can now go to the very end of the Moreh Nebuchim. So in the first chapter of Zamor Nebuchim, he talks about that we were created B'Tzelem Elohim, in God's intellectual image. And in the end of Zamor Nebuchim, the very last chapter, in Book 3, Chapter 54, he explains how man can achieve human perfection. And for Rambam, who is very, very influenced by Aristotelian philosophy, and Aristotle very much focused on the intellect, Rambam explains that the ultimate height of human perfection that only humans can achieve, not the lower forms of creation, is intellectual perfection. Now, this form of human perfection is not that I amass all of the knowledge that's possible, but specifically refers to our understanding of God, our understanding of our relationship with God. So look what he writes in source number 3 below. This is in the final chapter of Mor Nebuchim, as he's explaining the ultimate heightened form of human perfection. He says this highest form of human perfection, number 3, consists of the acquisition of the rational virtues. I refer to the conception of intelligibles, which teach true opinions concerning the divine being. This is in true reality the ultimate end. This is what gives the individual perfection, a perfection belonging to him alone, and it gives him permanent perdurance. Through it, man is man. So for Rambam, the highest form of human perfection is intellectual perfection, and that entails coming to an understanding, a spiritual understanding of our relationship with God. This is what distinguishes man from all of the lower forms of creation. This is what gives him his ultimate purpose in life. This is how he achieves purpose. Okay, with that understanding, now let's go to the rest of the pshat. Let's go back to Bereishit Perek Aleph. Okay, if you follow along with me in the text, you see in Bereishit Perek Aleph, right after Hashem creates man, B'Tzelem Elohim, he gives him a command. He says in Pasuk Kafchet, V'yivareh otam Elohim, V'yomer lahem Elohim, Peru erbu umalu at arz v'kibshuha, Rizu v'zgat hayam uva'ov ha'shamam uva'chol chaya ha'rometet ala arez. Hashem blesses man, and he tells him, he gives him the command of be fruitful, multiply, conquer the world, dominate the fish of the sea, the birds in the sky, all of the animals on the earth. And then he goes on in the next couple of psukim by telling that he's giving man everything at his disposal. V'yomer Elohim in Pasuk Haftet, Hinei natati lachem et kol esem zora zara asher al pnei kol ha'aretz v'kol es asher bo pri esorea zara lachem yelochla. He's given him all of the vegetation at his disposal for man's use, for man's sustenance, etc., etc. And in the last pasuk of that parak, it says, V'yar Elohim et kol asher asah, Hashem saw all that he did, V'hinei tov ma'od v'hi erev yivoker yom ha'shishi. Hashem saw all that he did, it was great for him, he was very pleased with it, and it was evening, it was morning, and the culmination of the sixth day. However, we have in Perek Bet an additional view of creation, and there we have the creation process from the perspective of man, or with the focus on man. And there we see, starting in Bereishit Perek Bet, Pasuk Zion, V'yatzar Hashem Elokim et ha'adam afar min adama v'yipach ba'apav nishmat chayim v'hi adam l'nefesh chaya. Hashem forms man out of the afar, out of the dust of the land. He breathes within his nostrils the breath of life. V'yatzar, in the subsequent pasuk chet, Hashem Elokim gan re'edem ikedem v'yisim shem et ha'adam asher yatzar. Hashem creates, Hashem plants this Garden of Eden, and he places man there. V'tzmach Hashem Elohim et min ha'adama kol et nechma l'mar'e v'tov l'ma'achal v'et ha'chaim v'toch ha'gan v'et ha'dat tov ra. So Hashem sprouts up from the land all of these wonderful trees that were good to look at, good to eat, and among which was the Eitz HaChayim, the tree of life, in the middle of the garden, and also the Eitz HaDat Tov V'Ra, the tree of knowledge of good and bad. V'yikach Hashem Elohim et ha'adam v'yinachiv b'gan Eden l'avda l'shamra. Hashem takes man and he puts him in Gan Eden to be an eved, to serve him, and to guard it. And then it says, V'yikach Hashem Elohim et ha'adam l'mor. And then Hashem gives him the command. Hashem says in Pasuk Tet Zayin, V'yikach Hashem Elohim et ha'adam, Hashem commands Adam, saying, and this is the command, and we'll come back to this throughout this year, Mikol et ha'gan achol tochel, from all the fruits of the trees, you can surely eat. You should certainly eat. Akol Tochel, right, the Kefa Lashon, the double language. Ume'et Adat Tobara, lo tocham nimenu, ki biyom ha-chacham nimenu mot tamud. But of the tree of knowledge of good and bad, you should not eat of it, and or else you will certainly die. On the day that you eat from it, you will certainly die. Vayomer Hashem Elokim, lo tov hayot adam levado aseh lo ezer kenegdo. We see immediately after his command, after the prohibition of eating from the Eitz Hadat, Hashem says to Adam, it's not good for you to be by yourself. I'm going to make you an ezer kenegdo. In the subsequent sukkim, I'm going to make you a helpmate. In the subsequent sukkim, Hashem creates all of the different animals, the birds, everything else for man to find an ezer kenegdo, a helpmate. Man is unable to find one, and there is a pasuk kaf aleph, v'yipol Hashem Elohim tardema al Adam, v'yishlam v'yikach chachan mitzalatav mimene basar tachtena. Because Adam is not able to find an ezer kenegdo from all of the different creations that Hashem has created, Hashem makes a deep sleep fall upon Adam, and Hashem takes mitzalatav from his ribs or from his sides, a different translation, and he makes woman out of man. And then he closes up Adam, right? And in the subsequent sukkim that I haven't quoted for you, it's the last couple of sukkim in Perek Bet, it just has Adam naming her Isha, because from Ish she was taken. And then the last pasuk there says that they were Arom, they were naked. However, lo yitboshashu, they were not embarrassed by their nakedness. And now we get to the Gan Eden narrative. If you look in Perek Gimel, the beginning of Perek Gimel, you see, והנחש היה ארור מכל חיית השדה אשר עשה השם אלוהים, ויאמר עליך, אף כי אמר אלוהים, לא תאכלו מכל עץ הגן. So we're introduced to a third character. In addition to Adam and now Chava, or the Isha, we have a third character, and that's the Nachash, the snake. And the Nachash is described by the Torah as ארור מכל חיית השדה, as more cunning, more sly. Arum has also been translated as Chacham, smarter than the other beasts of the field that Hashem has made. And the Nachash says to the Isha, Ach ki amar Elohim lo tochlu mikol et hagan? Has Hashem told you not to eat from any of the trees of the garden? To which the Isha responds, and look at the Isha's response and have in mind, because again, we're going to come back to it a little bit later, have in mind how she distorts the actual command in her recounting it for the Nachash here. Look what she says in Pasuk Bet and Gimel. The Toma Harisha, the woman says to the Nachash, Mipri ha'et ha'gan nochal. We can eat from the fruits of the tree. Umipri ha'et asher batoch ha'gan, amar lohim lo tochlu mimenu, velo tig'u bo hen tumutun. But from the fruit of the tree that's in the middle of the garden, Hashem says we cannot eat from it, and we cannot touch it, lest we die. Okay, we're going to get back to why she distorted and how she distorted it, but just note the distortions in her recounting of it versus what was the actual command given to Adam in the previous parak. So look what the Nachash says. V'yomer ha-Nachash al-Isha, lo mot tamutu. And the Nachash says to the woman, you're not going to die. Ki yodei Elohim ki v'yom ha-chachem imenet v'nitzkecho anechem v'yitem ke Elohim yodei tov v'ra. He says, you're not going to die. The only reason Hashem gave you the command, Hashem knows. Ki yada Elohim, Hashem knows, ki biyom achalchem mimenu, that the day that you eat from it, v'nifkuchu enichem, your eyes will be opened, v'yitem ki Elohim yodei tov v'ra, and you will be like Elohim, knowing good and bad. V'tera ha'isha ki tov ha'et l'machal, v'chi ta'avaku le'enayim, v'nechmar ha'et l'azkil, v'zikach m'piryo v'tochal, v'titen gam l'isha ema v'yochal. So the woman sees that the tree looks good to her, it's desirable in her eyes, she deems it good, and therefore she takes from the fruit, she eats it, and she also gives to her isha, her husband to eat. The tipakach ne'enei shneihem, immediately after their sin, the tipakach ne'enei shneihem, the eyes of both of them opened, v'yed'u, and they knew, ki erumim heim, that they were naked, and then immediately v'tru alei ta'inav yasu lahem chagoret. They went and they tried to cover themselves up by making themselves some clothes. Even though they weren't embarrassed before, now all of a sudden they were embarrassed because of their nakedness, and they hear Hashem's voice, and they go and hide behind the trees. Because Hashem Elohim el Adam v'yamarlo, Ayeka, Hashem calls out the man, and he says, where are you? V'yomer et kolcha shamati began v'ira ki irum enoche v'achabei. And Adam responds by saying, I heard your voice in the garden, and I was scared because I was naked, so I hid. V'yomer, and Hashem says, mi hiki lacha ki irum ata? Hamin ha'et asher siviticha levilti achol mimenu achalta? And so, Hashem says to Adam, who told you that you were naked? Did you eat from the forbidden tree? Now we're going to stop there in order to look at some of the philosophical interpretations, and then we'll come back to Adam's response to Hashem, and also to the Adam and Chava and the Nachash's subsequent punishment. But what I want to deal with now is the philosophical problems that arise from the text. Essentially, the problem that we've already stated, based on our understanding of Tzelem Elohim, is if Adam was created as Tzelem Elohim, if Adam was created in this intellectually perfected state, why does he only get this yodea, this das, tov v'ra, this knowledge of good and bad, after his chet, right? It seems like he's getting an additional amount of knowledge. Now that's problematic if he was created intellectually perfect, and it's also problematic if we say that he gets it only after his chait, because it's as if he's being rewarded by more knowledge as opposed to being punished as a result of the chait. And a further problem is, if he didn't have the ability to discern between good and bad prior to the chait, how can we justifiably understand God giving him the command altogether? So these are the questions that Rambam, that Maimonides, deals with in the very next chapter of the Moreh Nevuchim, in Perek Beth, Book 1, Chapter 2 of the Moreh Nevuchim. Okay? So it's going to deal with these philosophical problems that we just articulated with this Gan Eden narrative. Now we're going to look at the whole excerpt from Chapter 2, but I don't want to start at the very top. I want to start right here at the beginning of this second paragraph, and then we're going to go back in a few minutes to the first few lines. Now look how Rambam explains this narrative, being consistent with his earlier chapter, which talked about Tzelem Elohim, that God was created in man's that man was created by God in God's intellectual image. Okay, so look how he begins here. He says, for the intellect that God made overflow into man, and that is the latter's ultimate perfection, was that which Adam had been provided with before he disobeyed. It was because of this that it was said of him that he was created in the image of God and in his likeness. It was likewise on account of it that he was addressed by God and given commandments. For commandments are not given to beasts and beings devoid of intellect. Through the intellect, one distinguishes between truth and falsehood, and that was found in Adam in his perfection and integrity. Okay, so far Rambam is completely consistent with his earlier parak, where he describes Adam being created, B'Tzelem Elohim, in God's intellectual image, that God created man in this ideal, intellectually perfected state. Okay? So, we understand that so far. Now Rambam's going to make a distinction between two levels of knowledge in order to deal with the philosophical problem that we articulated before. That it seems as if he's being rewarded by getting more knowledge, the das tov v'ra after his chait, when really he should be punished. So look at how Rambam distinguishes different types of knowledge in order to reconcile this problem. So look what he says here. He says, good and bad, on the other hand, belong to the things generally accepted as known, not to those cognized by the intellect. For one does not say it's good that the heaven is spherical and it's bad that the earth is flat. Rather, one says true and false with regard to these assertions. Similarly, one expresses in our language the notions of truth and falsehood by means of the term emet and sheker, and those of good and bad by means of the term tov and ra. Okay, so he's distinguishing between two levels of knowledge, emet and sheker on the one hand, the knowledge of truth and falsehood, that's the ideal knowledge, that's the highest level of knowledge, this is objective, theoretical truth, versus a lower level of knowledge, an inferior knowledge, the knowledge of tov and ra, which is the level of knowledge of moral norms, of social values, of subjective things. So look how he continues. He says, now, man, in virtue of his intellect, knows truth from falsehood, and this holds good for all intelligible things. Accordingly, when man was in his most perfect state, in accordance with his inborn disposition, and possessed of his intellectual cognition, he had no faculty that was engaged in any way in the consideration of generally accepted things, and he did not apprehend them. Okay? So essentially what Rambam is saying is that pre-sin, Adam was intellectually perfect, and he was concerned only with the emet and sheker, this theoretical, ideal, objective knowledge. Now, according to Rambam, the fall of man, man's sin, is reflected in a change of his priorities. Adam went from being focused and interested only in things of the mind to being interested in things of the body. And therefore, pre-sin, he wasn't concerned with matters relating to values or social norms, but only with the emet. Post-sin, as a result of the sin, Adam was no longer concerned with the emet and sheker, but rather with the tov and the ra, with things that were generally accepted, with subjective, with relative moral judgment, with a lower level of knowledge. So the prohibition, according to Rambam, not to eat from the Eitz Hadas, represents the values of the intellect, not to be concerned with the material. Whereas the Eitz Hadas symbolizes the world of pleasure, the world of desire. There's a question, is Adam understood by Rambam to be a real person or a concept? It's a good question. We're going to get to that in a second. Rambam, in general, usually has an allegorical interpretation for many of the biblical narratives in the Mor Nebuchim, and we're going to see that that's true here as well. Let's first have a look at that first part that we skipped of the Mor Nebuchim, and then I'll address that in particular. Okay? Okay, so go back to the beginning of chapter 2. So the first five lines that we skipped, now they become appropriate. Now, Rambam begins here by explaining an equivocal term. Rambam uses the word equivocality a number of times in the Mor Nebuchim. The word equivocality means that there are terms in Tanakh that have more than one meaning. And this word Elohim that the Nahash uses, right, the word Elohim that he says to the Isha, the only reason Hashem doesn't want you to eat from the Eitz Hadas is because he's afraid you're going to be like Elohim Yodea Tov V'ra. Okay? So this word Elohim generally is translated in the Torah to mean God. The Rambam says, this is an equivocal term, and it has more than one meaning. And here, as in other references as well, the term Elohim should not be translated as God, but rather should be translated as ruler. So if you have a look at this, and I'll explain why in a second, if you have a look at the first few lines of chapter 2, let's look what he says. Rambam says, every Hebrew knew that the term Elohim is equivocal, designating the deity, the angels, and the rulers governing the cities. Unclus has made it clear, and his clarification is correct, that in the dictum of scriptures, and he shall be as Elohim, knowing good and evil, right, that's what the Satan said to the Isha to persuade her to eat from the eighth, the last sense, meaning rulers, is intended, for he has translated, and you shall be as rulers. So Rambam explains that this is an equivocal term, and therefore we're going to read it as rulers. I'll respond to the question that's posted in 2 minutes after I get to the metaphorical interpretation. Okay? So Rambam says that here Elohim needs to be understood as rulers. The Nahash was saying to the Isha, if you eat of the Eitz Hadas, you will be like Elohim, like rulers, knowing Tov V'ra. So how do we understand this according to Rambam? Rambam's explaining that human rulers were not the ideal political system in ancient times, but rather they were basically just imposed as a result of the insistence of the people. That rulers, human rulers in the political realm, had only the physical well-being of mankind in view, as opposed to in a divine state, in the ideal type of state, which took into account both the physical well-being of the citizens as well as their spiritual or religious well-being. So Adam sins by failing to emulate the ideal spiritual environment where he could focus on the emet, and instead he succumbed to that which was inferior. And as a result, he fell from his Selam Elohim ideal intellectually perfected status to a lower form of knowledge, that of Da'at Tov V'ra. Now, how could Adam fall prey to sin? If Adam was on this ideal intellectual state, how could he have so easily fallen prey to sin? So Rambam explains here, and we're going to see in the text in a minute, that Adam could really be understood metaphorically. And Adam represents the intellectual ideal. Now, in this metaphor, Chava, who was taken from Adam, represents matter, the material, physicality. And the Nachash represents the imagination. Essentially, in this metaphor, right, since Chava was created out of Adam physically, her character represents man's material component. And the flaw in man is that he not only has a soul, but also he has a body. And it's this component which prevents man from being a completely intellectually, or a completely spiritual, like angelic being. So the Nachash, who's representing the imagination, that which is not controlled by reason or by the intellect, has also been interpreted as the Satan or as the Yetzer Hara. Now Sforno interprets like that, and Sforno explains that the word Satan comes from the word satet, to turn away from. So the Satan, in a way, the imagination turns people away from the truth, from the emet. So in this metaphorical interpretation, Chava and the Nachash, symbolizing matter, physicality, and imagination, seek to break the hold of Adam, of the intellect, upon them. So the chet, the sin in Gan Eden, consists of following the imagination's desire for the material. So the imagination, or the Nachash, induces man's body, meaning Chava, the material, to pursue the physical desires, and thus keeps the intellect, keeps Adam from achieving spiritual or intellectual perfection. And if you think back to the text, if you look at Chava's motivation for eating the forbidden fruit, right back in Perek Gimel and Pasuk Vav, right, it says Kitavatu Le'inayim, right? She decided it looked good. She wanted to be like Elohim, judging things as good or bad. And from then on, man would no longer be in the state of emet v'sheker, but rather man would become preoccupied with judging things as good and bad, instead of transcending the level of moral judgment in pursuit of real value or truth. So now let's go back and read it inside in the Moreh Nebuchim. We stopped right here in the three dots. So he says here, however, when Adam disobeyed and inclined towards his desires of the imagination, right, that's the Nachash, and the pleasures of his corporeal senses, right, that's Chava, inasmuch as it said that the tree was good for food and that it was a delight to the eyes, right, the physicality was what tempted her, he was punished by being deprived of that intellectual apprehension. He was punished by being deprived of the Tselem Elohim, of the ideal state. He therefore disobeyed the commandment that was imposed upon him on account of his intellect, and becoming endowed with the faculty of apprehending generally accepted things, he became absorbed in judging things to be bad or good. Then he knew how great his loss was, what he had been deprived of, and upon what estate he had entered. Hence it is said, and you shall be like Elohim, knowing good and evil, and not knowing the false and the true, right? If you think back to the biblical text, right, that we saw first, it doesn't say, and they will be like Elohim, knowing emet and sheker, but rather the Nachash says, you'll be like Elohim, yodea tov v'ra, right? So with regard to what is of necessity, there is no good and evil at all, but only the emet and sheker, only the ideal intellect. Okay? So then he goes on to explain, reflect on the pasuk, and the eyes of both of them were opened, and they knew that they were naked. Hosin, right, they recognized their nakedness, and they were embarrassed. They had always been naked. However, before the sin, they weren't embarrassed by their nakedness. So look at a close reading of the text. Rambam explains, and the eyes of both of them were opened, and they knew that they were naked. The text doesn't say, and the eyes of both of them were opened, and they saw. For what was previously seen was exactly that which was seen afterward. There had been no membrane over the eye that was now removed, but rather he entered upon another state in which he considered as bad things that he had not seen in that light before. So it wasn't that Adam all and Eva all of a sudden got some vision after the sin. It doesn't say the Tipakasna and Nation Viyiru and they saw that they were a room, that they were naked. No, it says, and the eyes of both of them were open, Viyidu, and they knew that they were naked. Meaning because they fell to this inferior level of knowledge, this knowledge of Tov V'Ra as opposed to the ideal knowledge of Emes and Sheker, in the realm of Emes and Sheker, there was no embarrassment associated with their nakedness. However, now in this inferior level of knowledge, the knowledge of moral norms, of social norms, of those types of values, there was embarrassment associated with it. And so it says they fell into a state in which they considered as bad things that they had not seen in that light before. So this is why Hashem then asks Adam in Pasuk Tet, Ayeka, where are you? Meaning Hashem knew where Adam was. Hashem was omniscient. Hashem was all-knowing. It's not that Hashem couldn't see Adam. So rather, what does the Ayeka mean? What does it mean, where are you? So the term Ayeka, where are you, that Hashem asks to Adam right after his chait, is where are you spiritually, right? How could you have fallen so quickly from your ideal Tzelem Elohim state? Now, before we go on with another philosophical interpretation, it's important to point out that God did not prohibit Adam from engaging in physicality altogether. Now, after all, Adam was created as a physical being, and he was even commanded, if you refer back to Perek Aleph, he was even commanded the Kishuha to take part, to create, to be dominant in the physical world. If you look back at the commands in Pasuk Kafchet, in the first source, Vivarech Elohim, Vivarech Otam Elohim, Hashem created man, he blessed them, Veyomer Lahem, and he said to them, Haru Urvu, Meluat Arts Vikivshuha, you should be fruitful, you should multiply, you should fill the land, and you should dominate it. Urzu Vitgat Hayam, but you should conquer it, Vikivshuha, contribute to it, conquer the world. Urzu Vitgat Hayam, dominate the fish in the sea, Uvof Hashamayim, the birds in the sky, Uvof Hayakur Meshet Ala Arat, and all of the beasts on the field, right? So Hashem very much wanted Adam to take part in the physical world, wanted Adam to conquer the physical world. However, there's a duality described in the creation of man, and this duality is emphasized in Perek Bet, where Adam, having just received this command, Vikivshua, dominate the physical world, receives another very different command. If you look in Perek Bet, which we already looked at, but I want to just highlight right here, after Hashem puts Adam in Gan Eden, in Pasuk Tevav in Perek Bet, he gives him an additional command. And there it says, Hashem put man in Gan Eden, le'ovda u'le'shomra, to be an eved, to serve him, u'le'shomra, to guard him, to serve and to guard, to be an eved and to be a shomer. Now Radak, if you look at the Radak right here at the very end of the first source, Radak interprets this command, V'rabotinu zekronot avacha, perushu b'mashal zavamru, l'ovda zetamur u'l'shamra elo mitzvot. Radak interprets the second command given to Adam in Perek Bet, to be an eved, to be a shomer, not necessarily in physical terms, but rather it's to be an eved Hashem, and to study, to engage in Talmud Torah, and to be a shomer means to be shmirat, to be a shomer mitzvot, to keep the mitzvot. So whereas the first command was very physical in nature, the second command was much more spiritual. You have to be an eved, you have to be a shomer, you should engage in Talmud Torah, you should engage in shmirat mitzvot. And it's this duality of these two commands, seemingly almost conflicting commands, that were given to Adam in Perek Aleph and Bet of Bereishit, that Rav Soloveitcher calls attention to in The Lonely Man of Faith. Now, in The Lonely Man of Faith, that was initially an article by Rav Soloveitcher that was published in Tradition in 1965. Subsequently, it's been published as an independent volume. And this Lonely Man of Faith, Rav Soloveitcher describes the duality within man. And he describes the Adam that's created, B'Tzelem Elohim, and who's given the commands of Vikivshua and Perek Aleph, he describes him as Adam 1, whereas he describes the second Adam, who's given the command of Da'al Shamra, who who's described in Adam, in Parakvet, he describes him as Adam too. So let's just look at Rav Soloveitchik's word, in Rav Soloveitchik's own words, how he describes the difference between the two characters, the characteristics of Adam 1 on the one hand, and the characteristics of Adam from Parakvet, Adam 2 on the other. So if you look at source number 5, he says as follows. There is no doubt that the term image of God, Tzelem Elokim, in the first account refers to man's inner charismatic endowment as a creative being. Man's likeness to God expresses itself in man's striving and ability to become a creator. Adam 1, who was fashioned in the image of God, was blessed with great drive for creative activity and immeasurable resources for the realization of this goal, the most outstanding of which is the intelligence, the human mind, capable of confronting the outside world and inquiring into its complex workings. In spite of the boundless divine generosity providing man with many intellectual capacities and interpretive perspectives in his approach to reality, God, in imparting the blessings to Adam the first and giving him the mandate to bikishuha, to subdue nature, directed Adam's attention to the functional and practical aspects of his intellect through which man is able to gain control of nature. Adam the first, or Adam from Parak Aleph, is interested in just a single aspect of reality and asks one question only. How does the cosmos function? He is not fascinated by the question, why does the cosmos function at all? Adam the first is overwhelmed by one quest, namely, to harness and dominate the elemental natural forces and to put them at his disposal. This practical interest arouses his will to learn the secrets of nature. He is completely utilitarian as far as motivation, teleology, design, and methodology are concerned. So Rav Soloveitchik describes Adam in Parak Aleph of Bereishit as a creative being. Adam, having been created in God's intellectual image of Tzelem Elokim, has the ability to understand and to work and to master and conquer the world, the physical world around him. He is utilitarian in his desires, he is ambitious, he's bold, he's aggressive, and he's creative. Now he goes and describes Adam 2. This is the Adam that was described in the second parak of Bereishit. This is the Adam that was given the commandment, la'ovdav u'lishomra, to be an eved, to be a shomer. So look how he describes him in a very different term. He says, Adam 2, while the cosmos provokes Adam the first to quest for power and control, thus making him ask the functional how question, Adam the second, or Adam from Parakvet, responds to the call of the cosmos by engaging in a very different kind of cognitive gesture. He does not ask a single functional question. While Adam 1 is dynamic and creative, Adam 2 is receptive and beholds the world in its original dimensions. He looks for the image of God not in the mathematical formula or the natural relational law, but in every beam of light, in every bud and blossom, in the morning breeze, in the stillness of the starlit evening. In a word, Adam 2 explores not the scientific abstract universe, but the irresistibly fascinating qualitative world where he establishes an intimate relation with God. So as where Adam 1 tries to be bold, creative, dominate the world around him, Adam 2 kind of is submissive in the awe of God's grandiose creation. Now, Rav Soloveitchik goes on to describe that Adam 1 and Adam 2 are taken from different communities. Adam 1 is taken from the majestic, natural, work community, whereas Adam 2 is taken from the covenantal faith community. We just have a quick look at this here. He says the communities of which Adam 1, the Adam from Parak Aleph, majestic man, is a member, is a natural one, a product of the creative social gesture in which Adam engages whenever he thinks that collective living and acting will promote his interests. Whenever Adam 1 wants to work, to produce, and to succeed in his undertakings, he must unite with others. Distribution of labor, the coordinated efforts of many, raise man above the primitive level of a natural existence, and grant him limited dominion over his environment. What we call civilization is the sum total of the community effort through the millennia. Thus, the natural community fashioned by Adam 1 is a work community committed to the successful production, distribution, and consumption of goods, material, as well as cultural. By contrast, the covenantal faith community of Adam 2, in contradistinction to the natural work community, interprets the divine pronouncement, "It's not good for man to be alone," not in utilitarian but in ontological terms. It is not good for man to be lonely. The natural community of Adam I is a community of interest, forged by the indomitable desire for success and triumph, and consisting at all times of two personae, the I and the thou, who collaborate in order to further their interests. The covenantal faith community of Adam II is a community of commitment, born in distress and defeat, and comprises three participants, I, you, and he, meaning God, the he in whom all being is rooted and in whom everything finds its rehabilitation and consequently redemption. Adam I met the female all by himself, while Adam II was introduced by Eve by God, to Eve by God, who summoned Adam to join Eve in an existential community molded by sacrificial action and suffering, and who himself became a partner in the community. God is never outside of the covenantal community. He joins man and shares in his covenantal existence. So Adam I is part of this natural work community where I join with you in order to produce more, in order to contribute more, in order to create more. The community of Adam II is very different. The community of Adam II is this covenantal faith community where I join with you in a covenantal relationship with God. So look how he now describes, even though he's thus far been describing Adam I and Adam II as very, very distinct beings, he's now explaining that Adam I and Adam II are really two components within each of us. Within each of us, we have an Adam I side and an Adam II side. We have a side that wants to engage and be aggressive and dynamic and bold and creative in the physical world. And we also have an Adam II side, a spiritual side, that requires that we be submissive and that we withdraw and that we focus on our spiritual relationship with God. So look how he describes this. We've been describing both Adams typologically, as though they were irreconcilable, separate persons with disparate temperaments and orientations. Actually, there's only one Adam with oscillating tendencies. The man of faith, in actuality, moves regularly between the faith community and the work community. He never remains totally immersed in the immediate awareness of being in God's presence. There's a continuous alternation between the cosmic and the covenantal, both areas being willed and sanctioned by God, who wants man to live creatively in this world, even as he devoutly participates in the faith community. Adam I and Adam II are truly one person, and every one of us there abides, the boldly creative and the devoutly submissive. Both tendencies are sanctioned by God. Rejection of either aspect of humanity is tantamount to rejection of the divine plan of creation. The Halakha believes that there is only one world, not divisible into secular and hallowed sectors. Accordingly, the task of covenantal man is to be engaged not in the dialectical surging forward and retreating, but in uniting the two communities into one community where man is both the creative free agent and the obedient servant of God. So we see in Rav Soloveitchik's text that it's not that we have to be either Adam I or Adam II, and it's not even that Adam I is greater than Adam II or Adam II is greater than Adam I. Both are commanded. Both are obligatory, right? If we negated one, if we only pursued one to the exclusion of the other, we're not following both of God's commands that he gave us at the inception of mankind in Bereishit. So the Torah or the mitzvot are really aiming at not focusing on one over the other, but rather just enabling us to kind of unite the Adam I and the Adam II within us to ensure that one doesn't dominate the other, to ensure that we subdue any sort of overindulgence that we might want to engage in the physicality, in order to make sure that we're also obedient to the demands of the spirituality, to the demands of our Adam II side as well. Now, the Abarbanel, which is the last source that I want to look at tonight, Abarbanel similarly describes like an Asian narrative according to how what we already saw in Rambam, now aided with Rav Soloveitchik's interpretation. If you look at his commentary, and we'll end with this source, he says, previously, his intellect, both practical and theoretical, was perfect. He's talking about Adam, of course. Was perfect, but his knowledge of good and evil was, of necessity, intellectual, pure, and not applied or prompted by worldly motives. So far, Abarbanel is in complete agreement with what Rambam said. Look how he continues. God also made available all the things necessary for human existence. Food and drink of the fruits of the garden, which he planted, and the waters of his rivers, right? So when it says that Adam was put in Gan Eden, Hashem put at man's disposal to satiate all of man's physical needs. Right? He even says, right before the prohibition, he says, Mikol etagan ochol tochel. Right? He uses the kei falashon, the emphasis, the dual language to say, from all the fruits of the tree, you should certainly eat. You should take part in this physical world. Right? V'kishua, you should conquer it. Then he goes on to say, but there's one tree that you're prohibited from. So he says, Abarbanel continues by saying, all this was in its natural state, requiring no labor or toil or human exertion. All was at his disposal so that he need not burden himself in satisfying his bodily needs, but could concentrate on the perfection of his soul for which purpose he was created. Again, similar to what we've already seen in Rambam. On this account, God commanded him to rest content with the natural things. He had furnished him with, not be attracted to luxuries which require resort to human artifice and worldly things, so that his intellect should not be diverted to the assuring of physical comfort, which is the reverse of the spiritual perfection that is the ultimate aim. The meaning of the decree and command of all the trees of the garden you may certainly eat was, I do not forbid you the things essential to your bodily sustenance for the trees of the garden and the tree of life, but you may not actually eat of the tree of knowledge of good and evil, by which is meant the indulgence in and study of worldly things, what is the good that should be pursued and the evil to be avoided, though you may look upon it and touch it, which is a minimal level of indulgence, just so much as absolutely necessary. Eating here implies the sustenance of the body from that food and the indulgence in it, and that the food ingested becomes identical with the body that absorbs it. So Abarbanel's interpretation is quite similar to what we've already seen from Rambam. Abarbanel says that man was given the ability to engage in physicality to satisfy all of his physical needs. Man, God realizes that man is not a holy, purely spiritual being. However, man can't allow his quest for the physicality, the quest for an overindulgence in the Eitz HaDaat Tov V'Ra, to sublimate his pursuit of spiritual perfection. And this was the nature of the chait of Gan Eden, according so far to Rambam and Abarbanel. Next week, we're going to look at the secondary sources, the more modern Jewish philosophical sources that will help us understand Rambam and Abarbanel's approach, and will also enable us to develop the idea of personal autonomy and religious authority that we're going to be able to extract from this biblical narrative. If anyone has any questions or if anyone has any comments, feel free now, and hopefully I'll see you all next week.